Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
You're jamming your favorite song, and while you aren't missing a beat, you could be missing a signal from your body. It's an SOS from your kidneys, and it doesn't sound like music at all. It's silent. High blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and other risk factors can quietly stress the kidneys, leading to negative impacts on the heart. That's why you should ask your doctor about a simple urine test called UACR. Most miss the signal for hidden kidney disease and related heart risk. You shouldn't. Visit DetectTheSOS.com today to learn more.
Good evening and welcome to Amplify, a telephone talk show that looks at life from a religious perspective. I'm Father Ron Lengwin, hoping that you have felt the warmth of God's love in your life this day, but especially the joy you feel when you share God's love with others. We need to be helping one another tonight. The high winds, 50 miles an hour to 60 miles an hour and even higher in our area. I was sitting, before I come into the studio, I'm in the newsroom, no one's there on Sunday evening, sit there and the police scanner was on, it's always on, and the calls were just unending about fallen power lines. And where I live, one block down was black, there were no lights there, and up behind us there were no lights there. So where we can help one another, let's do that. Certainly pray for one another. I would like, as we usually do, to begin our program with a story that is based on faith and formed with imagination, serves as a kind of introduction to our topic for the evening. The group of men continued to ask Jesus questions. He answered each of them carefully after great thought. After a while, Peter raised his hand and said, "The master is tired. He must rest now. We've many places to go, and so I must stop you." Jesus just looked at Peter and said, "A few more questions, my friend. These men have come a long way, and they deserve an answer to their questions." He said it in such a way that Peter knew that there was nothing he could say or do to stop Jesus from answering a few more of them. A young man stood up and said to Jesus, "I have listened to you for many hours, and the sun is now going down. I long to return to my family, but I cannot until you answer my question." Jesus said, "Then speak, my friend, speak." The young man said, "You speak about the importance of love, about caring for others, and sharing with them what you have. You ask that we extend compassion, understanding, a listening ear to the sick and to the poor. My father has many servants, and so do I. According to the law, we leave a certain portion of the fields for the poor and the old. Is this not enough? What about the Heavenly Father? What does he do for the poor and the hungry and the old? If he has so much compassion and tells us we must be compassionate and caring, Why has he not changed their plight? Why must we humans give so much to them while he does nothing? Jesus let the man go on and on. And then he raised his hand and said, "Will you let me speak now?" The man looked straight into Jesus' eyes and said, "Then speak." Jesus said, "The poor will always be with us. This is true. But we have much to learn from them, the sick, the hungry, and those without shelter or love. There is much to learn from all of life. It has much to teach us." Then Jesus looked down and seemed to be searching for something. He walked over to a rock, pulled a flower from one of its crevices, a flower that had grown there from a seed blown by the wind, and said, "Have you ever seen a flower looking down at its shadow? Does it not always look up at the Creator? It looks up to the sky and not down at the earth. Maybe we should be more like the flower and try to be more kind and understanding to those less fortunate than we." A story of faith and imagination. Our guest this evening writes these final words, among the final words, not the very last words, but among the final words in his latest book titled, "You Welcomed Me," subtitled, "Loving Refugees and Immigrants Because God First Loved Us." Again, his words. The Savior came as a kind of immigrant from heaven, across borders of divinity and time and space, to walk among humanity. Soon after his birth, his family fled as refugees. He grew up and described himself as someone without a place to lay his head. He hung on the cross, forsaken by all, and then was raised to life. His most influential interpreter traveled to different lands, enduring hardship in and out of prison, in order to tell people that through Jesus, they belong to God's chosen people. The end of the story, which we're still living into, is to be finally fully home with God and with people from all corners of the earth. We care about refugees and immigrants because in so many ways God tells us to, and because they're living out of the longing of our story. This isn't just being tender-hearted. If this story, the story of God, is our story, then the Christian logic of love demands we help people who are in between, searching, wandering, exiled, seeking home. When we do, helping those without homes brings home a little closer for all of us by being part of the answer to Jesus' prayer that the kingdom would come, even here, even now. That kingdom coming happens in part, Jesus says, when we welcome a stranger, because then we're welcoming him, the one who is the way, truth, and life. Something mystical happens when our practical responses within the change that happens in the one who is welcomed and in the one who welcomes. Our guest who's been with us twice before is Kent Annan. He's a director of humanitarian and disaster leadership at Wheaton College, where he provides leadership to the MA program within the Humanitarian Disaster Institute. He is the author of Slow Kingdom Coming, Aftershock, and Following Jesus Through the Eye of the Needle. He worked for 2 years in Western Europe with refugees in Bosnia, Iran, Sierra Leone, and many other countries. He later worked for 6 months with refugees in Albania and then in Kosovo. Kent is a senior consultant at Development Associates International, which trains Christian leaders around the world. He co-founded Haiti Partners, lived in Haiti for 2.5 years, and spent 15 years working on education with churches in Haiti. He is on the board of Equitas Group, a philanthropic organization that seeks justice for the vulnerable and encourages holistic thinking about justice. Ken Annan, welcome back to Amplify.
It's so great to be back with you, Ron.
I loved our interviews because of what you brought to it. And anytime I see you have a book and I know about it, I'm probably going to see if you're available. So thank you. Why don't you? I love the book because you tell stories galore, and that's the way in which we're communicating a lot these days through story, telling stories and what we can learn from them, stories that we can enter into ourselves, stories that help us to remember our own stories, and ultimately for all of us who are Christians, and to remember the story, of course, the story of God, the story of Jesus. And so recount for us the story that you had, that your son told with your son when you, at the beginning of your book.
Yes. Thanks. It's so great to be with you. And I was starting to work on this book just because it felt like, you know, in our country and in our world, we're in this stage of wrestling with this idea of immigrants and refugees and how welcoming we're going to be or not. And so at the time, my office where I was writing was actually our closet in our bedroom. And so I had a little desk in there. And so I was in there working and came out to the living room, and I was playing with my son, and as we were talking, getting ready to play, and any play with him means a wrestling match may break out at any moment, whether we're ready for it or not.
Yes.
And so start talking with him and going back and forth, and I say, oh yeah, you know what I was just working on? I'm working on my new book. You know what it's going to be about? And I say immigrants and refugees. And he says, I know, Dad, you told me that last week. And then we kind of get to playing and wrestling around. And I say a little bit more about immigrants and refugees. And then he pauses there, he was 7 or 8 at the time, and pauses and says, wait, Dad, are we for them or against them?
Yes.
And it stopped me in my tracks. And I think in the writing, I was even a little confused at the moment, because how do you take on an issue so complex? And what was beautiful about that question is I think he named the issue for me, you know, as I was writing, and me and our family and our lives. But I think for us as individuals, as families, as churches, as a country, in one way, it's really simple. Are we for them or against them? It doesn't mean all the policy decisions are going to be easy afterwards. Not that there aren't going to be hard things to wrestle with, but I loved his question that really ended up being a guide for me on how to think about this question of are we for them or against them, and looking to, like you said, stories of people and the story of God and the stories of our lives to see where that would lead when it comes to immigrants and refugees.
What were some of the things you told him were at stake?
Yeah, I think for what's at stake that I told to him, and I've been thinking about for the last few years, is that, you know, there's a lot at stake for the lives of these people, you know, 21, 22 million refugees and another 40 million or so people who have had to flee their homes within countries. So they haven't officially crossed the borders, so not refugees, but, you know, so it's around 60 million people who have had to flee for fear of persecution and violence. And so I think for them, there's a lot at stake. Like, are they going to live or not? Are they going to have a home? Will they be able to have anything of normalcy? But then at the same time, what's at stake for us as families and as a country is, are we people who are welcoming or not? Are we people who are generous, or are we people who are just protecting ourselves? Are we people who are looking out for the other person, or being turned inward in a way and being deformed by idolatries or by ethnicities and all of this? So the more I thought about his question, it pushed me to think, well, there's more at stake even then, and this would be more than enough reason, 60 million people in this kind of situation, and hundreds of millions more if you think of immigrants. But I think there's really so much at stake on what kind of people are we going to be. Are we going to be our worst selves? I think sometimes the issues of immigrants and refugees can lead us toward, or are we going to be our most generous and loving selves. So I think that's some of what's at stake in this conversation.
Right, and if I can amplify on that, some of the things in addition to that, what's at stake? Love versus fear, who we want to be, what home is, how we deal with real concerns, how we make difficult decisions about responding to one another's suffering, wisdom versus naivete, versus ideals, the future of our nation, the way ethnicity and race affects lives and relationships. What is the crisis you believe we are presently in?
I think it's this crisis of who are we going to be? Are we going to kind of huddle in fear and say, okay, there's some risk in welcoming others, a risk of, I think a lot of this is not true, but I think the fear that's felt is there a risk of cultural change? Is there a risk, some economic risk? Is there a security risk here? And these fears can, I think, sort of deform us and have us to lead us to people who are fearful and sort of huddled or, you know, sort of within our shell like turtles and missing out on being our best selves and leaving a lot of people in suffering. So I really think there's a tremendous amount at stake of are we going to be people of love and welcome, and which we do wisely and with study and with caution, or are we going to be kind of our worst selves that just care about us and less guided by the suffering of others? And I think that can lead us towards a place of what we really most deeply don't want to be.
And the short answer to your son was that you want him to see that we're for them.
Yes.
We're not against them. And because as we look at this crisis, look at what is happening, we could easily say in so many different ways, that could be me, couldn't it?
Exactly. And I think this has been a gift I've had in being able to travel and work in some different places over the years. And so it's been clear to me, but I think it can be available to all of us if we look at the news, if we think about people we know. And I you know, take the caravan, for example. A lot of people saw in the news of people coming up from Guatemala and other countries who are escaping danger and violence down in their own countries. And I think we can look at something like that, a caravan of people, and it's a pretty human response to look at people like that in those circumstances and say, oh, you know, who are they and what are their lives like? And, well, that's just someone else who should be kept at our border, and we need to follow the rule of law, and almost think of them as something other than ourselves, you know, just as, yes, oh, these other people in this other world who live, speak a different language and look a little bit differently than us, and this kind of other. And I think that's sort of that we can make us a little bit fearful and also makes it like, oh, let's stay safe and we don't even have to think about them too much. But for me, if we think about Jesus saying, love your neighbor as yourself, as sort of an invitation into imagination. And I think if we pause briefly and look at people in a circumstance like that and say, oh, wow, that could be me there with my two young children, having had to leave my job and my kids' school and my home and my family and my community and everything behind, and to be on a road not clear that it's going anywhere, and that's how desperate I am to try to care for the people I love. And if I pause and I think, wow, that could, you know, for just the fortune of where I'm born, that could be me in that circumstance. Suddenly what that mm-hmm. does is makes me pause long enough to see it completely differently. And when I see it that way, I think that could be me. Suddenly I'm operating from a position of saying, wow, I'm feeling empathy, and instead of what's the least we could do or how do I keep myself safe, then I'm brought to a spot of saying, wow, is there any way that we can help? Or, you know, what's the most generous policy that we can have to help that out? Because frankly, if that were me and my kids in that circumstance, I hope someone else would be looking at me in that way and thinking about how they could help me.
You point out that their lives are asking us, will you welcome me? And you write in your book, you welcomed me. That could be me, loving my neighbor as myself and discovering that in the deepest sense, we're all exiles trying to find home. Following Jesus means, to some extent, confessing that we don't have a permanent home here. We want to belong most of all to God's kingdom coming. We're also to live with an eye to helping widows and orphans out on the margins. This isn't liberal wishy-washiness or conservative literalism. This is the rigorous life of love worth living, love that opens the world to us, that leads us toward discovery and transformation. It leads toward the discomfort of growth. We carry the weight of caring and then find our hearts grow stronger. So we become better for it in the long run, don't we, when we respond?
Absolutely. I think that way. And I think if all of us think of neighbors we've helped, or people in our church, or loved ones who've gone through serious illness, you know, it can feel like a burden, and it feels it's work, and it's going out of our way and taking on extra cares. But the beautiful thing is that it changes us for the better, too. And so I think that's part of the opportunity with this issue of immigrants and refugees. And it reflects the way that life is, too, where it's hard and love is demanding, but it also opens up a chance for us to grow and become better people, too.
You point out in the book that the crisis is nationally, globally, and existentially because 66 million people, and this is written a while ago, it may even be higher than that now, because 66 million people have been forced from their homes. 44 million of them are displaced within their own countries. 22 million had to flee their country as refugees because of persecution, war, or violence. This crisis is a large-scale version of times when a friend or neighbor had an emergency. We're going to take this break, and then we'll be back to continue speaking with Ken Annan about his book, You Welcomed Me, Loving Refugees and Immigrants, Because God Loved Us First. Welcome back to Amplify, where our guest this evening is Kent Annan. We're talking about his latest book, You Welcomed Me. We've talked with him previously, other two books in the same area. He explores how fear and misunderstanding often motivate our responses to people in need and invites us instead into stories of welcome, stories that lead us to see the current. It is very current, isn't it? Refugee and immigrant crisis in a new light. And he writes in the book, Jesus taught us how to see each other. God's love welcomes us so that we want to welcome others. In a way, that is gritty and practical, but also kind of mystical. Welcoming the stranger is also welcoming God. In our tender frailty and shared sorrow, in our courageous resiliency and remarkable generosity, in our fierce commitment to finding ways forward, in our deepest sense, we have an opportunity to do nothing less than to find a way, even when it isn't easy, to welcome each other and God into our lives. Kent, how is it that we're welcoming God into our lives when we act this way?
Yes, it's a great question. It does feel like something that's so practical, Father Ron, but also mysterious. And I think if we stand back, we can sort of feel it and touches on things we've already been talking about here. But for me, it's Jesus says in Matthew 25, he kind of tells the story of sort of an end judgment and goats and sheep being separated, and then in there says to people, oh, when I was a stranger and you welcomed me. Sort of people are wondering when they encountered Jesus and why they were being judged well. And Jesus says, oh, I was there. I was the one that you gave water to. I was the one that you visited in prison. And I was a stranger and you welcomed me. And I think Jesus is telling us there's something profound and mysterious that we can't totally understand, that we get to meet God and meet Jesus when we welcome the stranger, as when we help other people in these vulnerable circumstances. But there's also something that for me at least, I think in many people I've talked with, where, oh, we do know something of generosity and grace and meaning when we're able to be there for someone else when they're really in a place of profound need. And, you know, if you think of someone who's lost their home and you get to help them and give them home or give them food or teach them a language so they can make their way, there's something there that's just kind of worked. And maybe you're, you know, helping set up an apartment, or you're sitting in a, like many people do each week in the public library, Carol, or, you know, in a church basement, helping immigrants or refugees work on their English classes. And there's something that's really just normal day to day, and you're working on verb tenses and you're working on how to ask about the weather. But there's also this mysterious thing that I think changes us, and we realize we're stepping close to something where our lives matter and it's meaningful, and we're touching something special, kind of beyond us, not just the other person there, but something beyond. And so I think that's what it means there, and I think it's something that Jesus is talking about in Matthew, that he wants to point us in this direction.
Why do you believe that we shouldn't fear terrorists or gang members hiding among those who want to enter our country?
Yeah, that's a great question. And in one of the chapters in the book, I talk about how I think we should take these fears seriously, and they're real concerns. And so I think respecting people who feel these and seeing these as totally legitimate questions. So I think that would be the first thing, is I think it's a good and fair question. Excuse me. And then I think at that point, there are a couple things we need to do. But one is that we just want to slow down enough to say, okay, what's the real story? We feel the fear of that, and we should, and we want to protect our loved ones here and care for them and care for our country and our communities. So then what's interesting is when we slow down enough to look at, oh, what are the facts about people who are coming in? For example, since 1980, no American has died from a foreign-born terrorist attack in the U.S. And you think, oh, that's since 1980, you know, almost 40 years, and say, okay, there aren't terrorists who are streaming across, you know, are coming across in these refugee populations. And no one, I think, is advocating for, okay, don't have any checks at the border and just, you know, invite anyone in who, no matter what their criminal background is. And so I think at that point, what we're pushed to say is, okay, what's the research? And it's interesting that a lot of research has shown actually communities that have more immigrants are actually safer than, like as far as crime, than communities that don't have any immigrants in them. And so we start to look at these and say, oh, what are the facts about people? And that helps us. And I think what it pushes us in the direction of is saying, okay, we feel fear, but we're not going to let fear direct us. We're going to let the facts direct us. And then what we're guided to, I think, is to say, okay, we're going to be welcoming and wise. So this isn't a choice of either security or welcoming. We can actually do both at the same time. And if we have the right policies at the border, if we're vetting the refugees who are welcoming, then we can say, okay, this isn't open arms and naivete that's hurting ourselves and hurting the people already in our communities. But it also doesn't mean that sort of false information is guiding the way either. And I think when we take in the right information, there's a way for us to see wisely is forward encouragingly, encouraged looking at all the research and seeing, okay, we can be welcoming and wise at the same time.
Looking at it from another side, I was surprised to learn one of the facts in your books where you said about 40% of Fortune 500 families were started by immigrants or their children. That sure shows a level of success.
Right. No, it's fascinating to see how much our economic growth is in many ways fueled by the immigrants, which I guess shouldn't be totally surprising since we are a nation of largely of immigrants as well. And to see that, you know, even right now in much of our country, even as we're in this moment of debating immigration and whether we're going to let people in or how we let them in, a lot of people around the country are saying we need more workers. Like, we actually don't have enough workers right now. And if you talk with people and look at, you know, how is Social Security, for example, going to stay sustainable, you know, in 20 or 30 years, a lot of people say it's going to take immigration because we're not having enough babies, you know, otherwise in the country without immigrants coming. So I think there are lots of benefits there. You're right.
You write that you've decided to put one or two suggested practices at the end of each chapter because we should want to be guided by God's agenda, which includes his unfailing love for us. Tell us a little bit about the end of the first chapter. The practice is responding within God's love for us. And you write about the traditional form of prayer called the examine.
Yes, I see this, and this is part of what I've enjoyed talking with you over the years and think, we can talk about these issues, and we want to talk about social issues and the economics involved, but I think fundamentally these issues are spiritual issues as well. And so I wanted to end each of these chapters and say, okay, I think there are spiritual practices at the end of these chapters that I wanted to give that are spiritual and also practically engaging for people. So there's this practice of the examine where we look at our lives and look at how we are living and where we're being welcoming and where we aren't, and just wanted to adapt that to say, as we move forward into this, let's not rush into political debates and let's not just rush into reading research projects about it, but let's rush towards God and in these practical ways think about prayer and think about how we can be praying through and welcoming and really engaging with our neighbors in a way that's prayerful and in a way that we're asking God to shape us. So that was really the idea of having this prayer of examine be a way that we're thinking about and being guided into this subject.
In the second chapter, you begin with a story about Laura, who is a Fortune 500 executive. Tell us a little bit about that story and what we might learn from it, how we can recognize the stranger and then contact and help them when they may sit next to us on a plane and personally share their needs with us.
Yeah, so Laura is someone I really like a lot. She's been a business executive, and she was on a plane, I think, to do some lobbying in Washington, D.C., and she sat down, and there was some women who were young women who were especially tall were coming onto her flight as well, and she eventually noticed that they were a basketball team, a university basketball team, and sat down and was, you know, just going to prep for her meetings and, you know, be a sort of like a lot of business travelers and just have her head down and focus on what she had to do. And then one of the basketball players came over and asked her teammate if she would mind switching seats so she could sit next to Laura, because Laura looked like she didn't know her at all, but this stranger who was Laura looked like she might be comforting and welcoming to sit next to. And so this basketball player sat down next to her and sort of shared her fear, that she was really scared of flying and didn't like flying. And Laura kind of paused there, and where she normally would have just been focused on her own thing, suddenly, you know, she just opened up to this moment of helping a stranger through this difficult fear that she was feeling, and sort of one thing led to another, and she kind of talked with this woman, and then she offered to say a prayer, and she's an executive and a Midwesterner who's pretty shy and not given to doing that all the time. But she really was led in this moment to reach out and just provide this incredible welcome, and ended up holding this young woman's hand as they took off and through the flight and offered to help her down the road. And I just thought, that's part of, I wanted to tell some stories in the book. There were stories outside of refugees and immigrants just to remind us of how beautiful it can be part of either being welcomed or to be welcoming to others. And I thought Laura was a great example in this small way of welcoming a stranger in a moment that she could have ignored, but instead she was really generous with.
You write that in each person, in some mysterious way, we meet Jesus, and so we meet God, the Trinity in dynamic unity and diversity. And you said it's with a kind of three-in-one vision. In a person who was formerly a stranger to us, we can learn to see the person, a fellow human in distress. We can see ourselves, because that could be me, as we've discussed, and God through the mystery that in the other we meet the divine. So this theme keeps coming up in the various stories that you tell throughout the book. We could spend the whole time here telling stories about the refugee family, for example, which is who had to flee for their lives with their son, which is mirrors the story of Jesus and his parents. And you write about the fact that Uganda has received more than 1 million refugees, more than any other country, that they have their own problems. So by comparison, we do a lot less than other countries, don't we?
We do, and there's reason for that. Uganda is next to South Sudan, where they are, the crisis is happening, and most people, and it's best for most South Sudanese to stay in Uganda and other countries nearby, because hopefully they'll be headed back home, when it gets through a time of conflict. But at the same time, I've just felt it challenging personally and as an American to be there and think this country that has so many fewer resources than us had been quite generous and welcoming to 1 million people, whereas in contrast, I think last year the U.S. received about 22,000 refugees or 24,000 refugees. So it's quite a contrast, and I think we want to be challenged for generosity and think, okay, it doesn't mean we should welcome 1 million refugees and hopefully they're going to be going back home soon. At the same time, think, oh, if people with much less than us are being incredibly generous, and what are ways that we can be more generous?
Interesting part in the book, among many, is you talk about dehumanizing our neighbor scale, that there are ways in which we can do that, that we let a slur go uncorrected. We vote in a way that makes our vulnerable neighbors more vulnerable, or we fail to see God's image in them. And that's to be compared with recognizing our neighbor on what is called the Good Samaritan scale, that we take time to see someone else as a person, take time to feel their circumstances. We seek a tangible way to connect, to give, to share a meal. We live in a new understanding of who my neighbor is. And so you point out that seeing people other than our most immediate neighbors as neighbors disrupts the natural order of things, that in order to practice recognizing the stranger with the hope that we will be recognized as people who love, we in our families, churches, and communities need to stay off the dehumanizing our neighbor scale and instead progress along the Good Samaritan scale. Is that harder or easier than we may think it is?
I think it's harder for me. I appreciate your calling this out. And as I was thinking about the book and what was my contribution and, what could I say about this issue? And one thing I realized is, okay, this is a political issue, but it's, we already talked briefly about how it's a spiritual issue. And I realized actually a lot of this is, to use a kind of churchy word, is a discipleship issue. Or it's the issue of who's shaping us. And I know for me, I can be shaped by media. I can be shaped by politicians. I can be shaped by, scrolling through Facebook and Twitter feeds. I can be, there are just so many noises and voices coming at me all the time that I think lots of different things can shape how I start to think about the world and where my priorities are and where I'm putting time, if I'm being selfish, if I'm, wanting whatever the marketers are getting me to want. And so I just know that I'm vulnerable to being shaped by the voices around me all the time. And I think that's the same for us on this issue of immigrants and refugees, that if we are shaped by, you know, what news sources we listen to, shaped by politicians, we can shape by, you know, what the conversations are over the water cooler at work, and all these things. I think we want to be aware that they can shape us towards seeing people as more that could be me, and as people who in whom Jesus is present and fellow children of God, or they can start to shape me to think about people as people to be feared and people who are even less than human and people who don't deserve the same kind of life or opportunities that I face. And so I'm conscious that on this issue, but also on other issues, I'm vulnerable to being shaped by lots of outside voices. And so I wanted to talk about that in the book here, just as a way for us to think, okay, on this issue, there probably are voices shaping us. Let's be aware of that and make choices so that we're being shaped along a Good Samaritan or on a Jesus scale in how we're seeing our neighbors, and that's probably who we want shaping us, and not some of these other voices that want to shape us.
And as you point out, we see our story and other people's stories, and I read with interest, of course, the page where you talk about the Benedictine rule. I went to a Benedictine seminary for 6 years. And so I'm a little bit familiar with the rule of Saint Benedict, but you just heard about it 20 years ago, where the rule there is let all guests who arrive be received as Christ. And you speak about how it is that they welcomed you, didn't they, in a way you didn't expect.
Yes, exactly. You would know more about this than me, but I was just touched by this again, where it was this sort of mysterious thing for me as a Protestant who hadn't been around monasteries very much. And I went for a dinner at a monastery, visiting a friend that I think was doing a retreat there, and then was welcomed and had the leader there poured water over my hands and, you know, kind of wash my hands and welcome me. And there was just this really practical, gritty thing, but it also was entered into, oh, there's something really profound happening too.
Okay, let me break in there because we need to take this break. Welcome back to the second hour of Amplify, where our guest is Ken Dannon. We're talking with him about his latest book titled You Welcomed Me, Loving Refugees and Immigrants Because God First Loved Us. He is the director of humanitarianism and disaster leadership at Wheaton College. Kent, in the third chapter, it's titled Real Concerns, and you begin with the story of Megan, who has severe physical disability. I'd like you to tell her story, but it's within the context of the concerns raised about refugees and immigrants. You point out, first of all, you write, the biblical admonition, be not afraid, is a guide for how we welcome, and that concerns raised about refugees and immigrants are many, but love guides us to be both welcoming and prudent. And some of the concerns you raise and respond to them are, they'll take our jobs, we'll be risking crime and our security, we need to focus on taking care of our own, they're changing our town, we're letting too many people in, we're already too busy and overwhelmed, we're not sure what God is doing about all this. And the reason I'm asking to tell the story of Megan is because you begin the chapter with her, but you also end it with her. So tell us a little bit her story and pick out maybe one of the concerns that you'd like to talk about. And if you don't pick the last one, I'm going to pick it. Say, we're not sure what God is doing about all of this.
Yes. Well, thanks, Father Ron. It's so great to be with you tonight and with your listeners. So Megan, I heard her story, and she was a young girl who was born with this severe disease. Her parents and the doctors thought she, you know, wouldn't live long, right? Wouldn't live to be 5 or 6 years old even, but she made it to kindergarten, and she went to kindergarten, and at the graduation ceremony for kindergarten, the principal came up to the father, and the father had sort of had to beg the principal to take Megan in the first place, to welcome her into the class, and just because, you know, I think she's in a wheelchair, and just the amount of care, you know, the principal wanted to help out, but they were, just didn't know if they had the capacity to have her in the classroom, and eventually they did, and at the end of the year, the graduation ceremony, and Megan got the biggest applause of all, and then the principal came up to the father of this, of Megan, and said, you know, just wanted to let you know, when you first brought Megan here, you know, at the beginning of the school year, afterwards I got a lot of phone calls from parents who said, you know, we hope Megan, we wish all the best for Megan, we're sorry about her struggles. But we'd really like our child to not be in Megan's class, just because, you know, the amount of attention that will go to her will mean it's not going to our child, who you know, can be building a foundation for reading and education. And the dad was there who you know, knows the struggles that Megan faces, and he was just kind of wondering, why is the principal telling me this? We made it through, and now he's telling me that these parents didn't even want her in the child's, in this children's classroom. They didn't want their children to be in the same class with Megan. Why is he telling me this? And then the principal went on to say, and I just want you to know that the parents have been getting in touch with me recently and been saying, you know, Principal, this is a lot to ask, but we just, it was such an incredibly meaningful thing for our child to be in Megan's class. If there's any way we can do it, we'd love for them to get to be in her class again next year. And I sort of got chills in my, as a dad myself, I had some tears come to my eyes as I heard that story. And what I thought was so beautiful is the cost seemed too high at the beginning to think there would be the effort it would take to welcome Megan into class. And, oh no, would there be a cost to my own child and all that. And then what happened when they opened up the classroom and made the effort, did everyone realize, like, not only was it not worse, it was actually better than it would have ever been without Megan there. And so I just found Megan's story inspiring for, in and of itself, Megan and her family and that school. And then also thinking, oh, that's a bit of our concern, isn't it, with refugees and immigrants, that there will be too high of a cost. But I think for church after church and community that we talk with, I think when people come and then afterwards they think, oh, it was a lot of work, but we can't imagine our community or our church without them. And yes. So I thought Megan really can show us a way there, I think, and inspire us. And so I went into these concerns. So I'd love to talk about the last one with you, but I think one that I hear from others, and I'll touch on one other one first before we go into that one, is, you know, this concern about security, and I think jobs, economics, you know, are the two that come up most often in conversation. And I think for me, I was really encouraged reading the research and talking with people who work in this area to say, you know, really these neighborhoods with more immigrants tend to be safer. And again, it's not saying that that our hearts aren't with people who have had loved ones even murdered, you know, or that there isn't gang violence. Like, we're not denying that, but we're trying to look at the big picture and think carefully about these issues. I think the data on security is encouraging, that a lot of neighborhoods become better, and the vetting system for refugees is really effective to make sure they're not terrorists or people who would want to do harm to the country aren't coming. Actually, one of the things I've talked with refugees around the country, I think they sometimes find this narrative sort of discouraging and almost laughably discouraging, in the sense that they say, hey, like, we lost everything to violence. We lost our homes, our country, we lost everything to violence. Like, of any neighbors you're going to have that are going to be anti-violence, it's us. Like, welcome refugees into your neighborhoods. No one wants to be more peaceable neighbors than us, who know the high cost of having to flee home, and we want to contribute to a new home. So I think those are the one of the concerns that comes up, and it's encouraging how much they contribute to our economy and how much they contribute to safety, and that we can be wise on those accounts.
And then the last one, we're not sure what God is doing about all of this. You point out that it's something that people think, but they don't say out loud a whole lot. And and Megan comes up in part of what you've talked about her already, that Megan can, you know, just was such a great source of hope for them. You write, our hope is strong enough to overcome the fears and vulnerabilities we've just looked at. This hope that love will heal, welcome, and transform the world and our lives. And so she continued through first grade, through high school graduation. Then it was time for college. And her dad explained she was the only student to have to live in a wheelchair on a ventilator with 24/7 nursing, and that a lot of the students came for at a specific time when they knew she would need help, and helped her all the way through college. Amazing.
Yeah, it really is. And I think sometimes with a severe disability or like immigrants and refugees, I think maybe we stay away as we wonder, well, what's God doing here? It can be sort of on multiple levels, like that we don't want to step into the hardest suffering. And I think that's totally normal. But then it does seem like when we do with humility and with faith and with love, then often God can transform the moment and lead it to turn it into something more beautiful for us and the person who we're helping than we ever could have imagined.
So you're right that when we abide in love as love abides in us, and part of my homily this morning, I've taken the theological position that God loves us as much right now, today, as he will when we're face to face with God after we've passed from this life, because God only knows how to love in one way, and that's fully and completely. It's not, well, I'm going to love you more later when I see you, but no, just the very love of God is that way. And then you have, when we abide in love, we're able to cross over each of the concerns, and there are a bunch that we dealt with, two of them. You helped me even though you were concerned about your job and providing for your family. You took some risks to receive me, but not foolish risk. You reached beyond your tribe to help me belong. You faced the discomfort of change that I bring and sought the beauty in my presence. You opened the door to welcome as many of the people in situations like mine as you could. You slowed down to recognize me and recognize your privilege instead of walking past. Then you could help and we could find something more meaningful together. You looked for God in my suffering and my healing. You chose again and again to welcome hope and welcome me. We live in a world where sometimes it's difficult to keep hope alive. But we find it when we reach out to others who are in some need. And when we give them hope, then hope comes alive in us. This is our story. Tell us a little bit the story about Nicholas Winton.
Yes, so Nicholas, I think I saw this, one of those videos that pop up on Facebook or in a news clip. And he was a young man, I can't remember, maybe in his 20s, who during World War II, at the beginning of, right before World War II started, and he was British, living in England, and saw this news coming out about, Hitler's increasing influence and these children, especially who were in a kind of a refugee camp, who were kind of away from their parents, and what was going to happen, and their lives were increasingly seeming to be at risk. And he sort of said, oh, that's not enough, and I'm not just going to watch this from afar, but I'm going to do something. And he ended up helping out all these people, hundreds of children to escape from a camp in Europe before World War II came, when they would have certainly faced death. And instead were able to live. And that's an incredible story in and of itself. But then he was just kind of went, he did that, this incredible thing, and then just sort of went on with his life and decades later, BBC and the TV show kind of did something, and they brought him together when he was quite old, and they, without his knowing, had sort of filled up the room with these now middle-aged people who stood up at one point, and they were all people whose lives he had changed, whose lives were saved. They were the children who he'd helped to escape. And, you know, his story is obviously incredible on many, many levels, but I thought, oh, he was an ordinary man who was kind of led to having an extraordinary story because he didn't just let the news happen and sit passively, but he was willing to take the risk to try to welcome people who were vulnerable and in need. And I just thought that was a beautiful story that is in this, that extreme scenario, also speaks to how we can have stories that mean we're living better lives, but also ripple out so that many other people can have better stories when we take this risk to ask to help other people.
Some of the points you make are the refugee and immigrant stories are in many ways about us, and you tell three stories and to show how their stories are really like our stories. You note that on average, a refugee is in exile for more than 10 years, that who we are close to in many ways determines who do we become, and that we have to know our own story if we want to be a part of others' stories. And there are many stories that can change our hearts and minds. We've done this before when you've been on the program before, discussing two of your previous books. But tell us once again a little bit about your story.
Yes, I grew up. My dad was a minister, a pastor, and so one of the things I was grateful for, I think we had people from all different countries like countries of origin coming through our home, and our churches often were diverse like that, and we'd have missionaries come through and stay with us. And so I think that's part of what the story that I was born into was, that kind of place where we were just recognized the world and paid attention to it. And so I think that's part of what led me to, right after college, going to, for my very first job after graduation, I worked with a refugee ministry in Europe. So I lived in England and France and traveled a lot and was able to meet all kinds of people. And I think that's part of where you were asking me earlier about that could be me. And I think that's really where I woke up to that could be me, because I was living, for example, in one hostel, like a simple apartment in a slightly rough part of a city in France. And I was working with refugees, but actually also living in the building with them. And so I was playing ping pong and getting beaten in chess by the people from Sarajevo, where there was a war happening, and this guy who had escaped, and playing ping pong with guys from Sierra Leone, and they were just a few years older than me, and I just realized, oh, they'd had to leave everything behind, and they were in this place, and I just realized then, oh, that could be me. These weren't these other people out there, but that could be me. And so that really set me on a different path. I thought my life would go in a different direction, but those relationships and getting to be with them and do my small part to help was really impactful for me. And then I realized I needed more study and came back and went to a seminary, though I think mine was only 3 years. I think yours was longer. Went to seminary to study theology, just because I thought this was part of seeking after God and wanting to have tools to help and a way to think wisely about these issues. And then the day after graduation from the seminary, I got on a plane to go over to Albania, where there was a refugee crisis in Kosovo, a war in Kosovo, and Kosovars were coming into northern Albania. But I had also just started falling in love right before that, so I stayed for 6 months and came back. My wife and I were married, and then after 2 years of marriage, we moved to Haiti. So we got on a plane flew down, and within 24 hours we were living out in the countryside in Haiti with no running water, no electricity, and a tin roof over our heads, and living with a subsistence farming family, and they didn't speak English, and we didn't speak Creole, and we lived with them and learned language and culture, and ended up working on education issues. We lived there for 2.5 years, but I really did that for the last 15 years of working on education in Haiti. And then just the big change recently in this newest chapter in the story, my family and I just moved up. So we're a little bit cold and windy like you. And so we just moved up to Chicago in this past year because Wheaton College is launching a new master's in humanitarian and disaster leadership. And I thought, so I'm become the director of that. And I thought, wow, what an opportunity to serve a next generation of people going into this kind of work. And so wanting to serve them as they get ready to serve in the world. And I have a 13-year-old daughter and 9-year-old son and my wife. We're all here. So we're grateful for this story that God keeps leading us along and all the people we get to meet along the way.
Thank you for sharing your story with us. We're going to take a break now. Ken Annan, title of the book is You Welcomed Me. Welcome back to the final segment of Amplify. It's just about 20 minutes long. We have about 20 minutes, perhaps 25. We are talking with Ken Annan about his latest book, You Welcomed Me, Loving Refugees and Immigrants Because God First Loved Us. And Ken gets very practical, getting very practical in the fifth chapter of his book, after he states that we have a better chance of running the right race and running it well to the end whenever we do it together. And he started with a quote from Pope Francis on Good Friday. How can we not see the face of Christ in the face of the millions of exiles, refugees, and displaced persons who are fleeing in desperation? For every one of them, each with a unique face, God reveals himself always is the one who courageously comes to our aid. Ken, say a little bit about some of the practical ways in which we might be able to help locally or nationally or internationally.
Yes, I always think about it in those three ways further on. And I think locally there often what we can do is time or support to a local organization. We talked briefly earlier about volunteering to help with language acquisition. People are working on their language. I think it's such a practical way we can help. And then there are good organizations and often churches who are saying, you know, there are fewer people resettling right now, but still over 20,000 refugees who will settle this year. And so getting to be part of a team that helps a community resettle a refugee, you know, lots of practical things to be done there and helping along the way. And also one of the practical things locally is just friendship, that often it can be, you know, as any of us know who have moved to a new city, can you have a family over for a dinner or invite them along to some kind of event that will be meaningful to them. And I think these are these really practical, some that are longer commitments and some pretty simple that that can make a big difference for people. And then nationally, I think getting behind organizations that are doing good work. And I've got on a couple of lists, and there are a number out there where I can, you know, not especially partisan organizations, but organizations that are political in the sense of saying when there's legislation that can make a big impact on the lives of immigrants or refugees. And so I'll make a, you know, 5-minute phone call every couple of months to my representative or senator in these ways that we can give and help, but also engage, you know, to make our country a more welcoming place. And then finally, internationally, you know, it's hard for us to go far, but at all these levels, to be able to pray for both for the refugees and immigrants who are in these circumstances, I think is does more than we even know, but is so important for helping and for shaping us. And then also to be able to give, to because like we were talking earlier about Uganda, some of these places take the places close to the conflict where refugees are coming from are the places that bear the most burden of welcoming. So I think it's important for us to be able to give to help some of those organizations that are helping on the ground closest to the crises. So I think in terms of that really practical helping out locally in this more personal way, but wanting to be engaged in a few different ways to help as well.
And you write at that point, partnering well to welcome our neighbors should be more about accomplishing good and particularly about facilitating the agency of people so they can shape their own lives than about feeling good. Churches who have welcomed the refugees told me, quote, "Now we can't imagine our church without them," close quote. It's like after getting married, like after a child is born, or like foster parenting. After we welcome the very best into our lives, it's so much more complicated and demanding than we could ever have known, but also so much richer that we can't imagine life without welcoming. Probably should read that over again, because there is a real blessing for those who get involved in this effort, isn't there?
There is, for sure. It's sort of endless of everyone you talk with. And it's not that it's, not as you said, not that it's not demanding at times, but I think that there really is a blessing that comes in relationship as well as the ability to practically help.
And I remember the story, you tell the story about the chapter 6 is titled Form a Human Chain. You have a quote from Martin Luther King Jr., "We must learn to live together as brothers or we will all perish together as fools." Tell us about forming a human chain. I remember this story well.
Yeah, there's this family ended up, there was a rip current off the shore of Florida, and they were, so a family kind of one after the other had been pulled out into the sea, you know, maybe 100 yards out, and they couldn't swim back in because of the way the current was happening, and a couple people saw them and swam out to help, and then they couldn't swim back either. So it was this case, and people noticed them then offshore, and the family, and there were some kids there, and like they were going to drown. They were out there for 15, 20 minutes. People can only tread water for so long, and they realized this and realized they couldn't swim out, and what are they going to do? And then just people spontaneously started to form a human chain, sort of standing in shallow and locking arms, and person after person locking arms, and some of them couldn't even swim, and they locked arms and made this chain that went all the way out to reach this family, and then the family was sort of passed back along this human chain to make it back to shore. And I just love that image because it was this case where no one person could swim out and save them, but in humility, if each person worked together, they were actually able to reach out and do this incredible thing. So there's this mix of humility in it, of recognizing limits, but also doing something incredible to reach people who were in a dire circumstance that really had me thinking about this refugee situation that can be overwhelming if we read about it or think about people coming up in from Guatemala or Mexico or some of these countries where they're having some of these situations that they're having to run from. But if we each do our part, then we can accomplish pretty incredible things.
So one person is inspired, and that person opens the hearts and minds of others to see what is happening, and they become a part of it. And
yep, exactly.
wonderful things happen. We have just about 15 minutes, a little 15 before the program ends. You write about four commitments that can renew our strength while we serve then as vital links in a human change, and they are: commit to being a good neighbor despite the risks, commit to hope despite the despair, commit to reconciliation despite the fractures, and commit to grace despite the complexity. We could spend a lot of time on those, but say a little bit about them, about that commitment.
Yes, I was thinking, well, what are we committing to? And there are these sort of vision of healing and what we can do together. And I just thought of each of these commitments as a way to say, okay, we're committing to something practical, but sometimes it helps to know the meaning behind the work. They give us energy on those days when it feels like too much, or, oh, am I going to take on some other responsibility? And so to think about this commitment of grace despite the complexity, for example, is, oh, we're going to, like, we have God with us, and God's love is the guide, and we know we aren't going to know all the answers, and it's hard to navigate. But if we have grace, God's grace with us, in it, then we can jump in anyways. So I think each of those commitments I wanted to give inspiration, and I think the sort of theological backing for why we can get involved in being part of this human chain, and also to be encouraged in the meaning of it, and to know that it's worth doing, and that we're going to be sustained, I think, by God's grace and love and strength along the way.
You write, "You're very welcome" is a great greeting. "You're very welcome" is a greeting of each person along that chain, reaching out into the sea, out into the world, to help those we can. "You're very welcome in my life because I want to listen to you. You're very welcome in my life because this conversation may become something deeper. You're very welcome in my life because you're a child of God who is very welcome in God's love and life. We're welcomed by God's love, and so by grace, we practice welcoming. We fail, we break through, we keep practicing. We grow in faith and love by welcoming others. It would be great if our efforts were completely selfless, but know that it's not realistic. But we can't commit to helping in order to help, and also helping because it helps to shape us in the way of Jesus. This is the long obedience toward love, with a capital L. This is hope in the way love can work through us to help others, and through others to help us. We meet God together." We meet God together. And then in the final chapter of your book, which is titled "Here Is Life," and you have a quote from Soren Kierkegaard, "The highest and most beautiful things in life are not to be heard about, nor read about, nor seen, but, if one will, are to be lived." And you begin by writing, "I love it. Quote, I said after asking him to repeat it to be sure I heard it correctly, that's my favorite organization name ever. Here Is Life, they were called." Tell us about this organization.
Yes, I did. I sort of made them pause. I've worked in this nonprofit area, and so I've know of and met hundreds, thousands of organizations over the years, and so here I was in northern Uganda, and they said their organization name was Here Is Life, and I just loved it. And it was this local Ugandan organization, and foreigners weren't part of it, though they partnered with some foreigners in later time, but they'd set it up, and in part because they had in Ugandan history, these people had to flee themselves, and they were welcomed as refugees somewhere else, and they came back into Uganda, and they've started this organization, Here Is Life, sort of saying, "No, we're committed to helping our community, and not just our families, but to helping more broadly in our community." And then, what's beautiful is when they had when South Sudanese refugees came in to their part of northern Uganda, then, you know, Here Is Life was part of the local Ugandan efforts to receive them and say, "Okay, you've left everything behind, but Here Is Life too. We're going to be here for you, helping out in the way you welcomed us, so we are going to be welcoming you." And I just thought that was a great statement about where we started this conversation a couple hours ago, of like, God is there, even in these hard circumstances, and God's presence can really be there when we take the risk to help out, and in circumstances where it can seem like death is approaching and loss is winning because we've had to leave so much behind. What's amazing is that life can be there too, in a beautiful way when we reach out to help each other.
And we are being invited to into a new way of life, aren't we, in some sense?
I think that's a beautiful way of saying it. And I think the invitation is, you've said in your homily, you referred to your homily, that God's love is so great for us, that's the starting point. So it's not just that we want justice. It's not just that we want to help someone. But God loves us and loves us, as you said, loves us as much as God will love us when welcoming us fully in grace when our lives are done. And that's the love that we get to be compelled by, that we're so loved that we then get to love, that we're so welcomed that we can welcome others. And then it's not just out of duty or out of fear or out of some political vision, but it's out of God's love, and that will change us, won't it?
I certainly believe so. And what I do when I have someone like you who's been on the program before, I like to go back to see what it is that we talked about before, not completely, but I mark things in the books that I want to remember, I want to go back to, or I end up using them and making some reference to them in a homily. And I remember the last time you saying that there's a paradox at work here in this kind of work, that it's completely up to God, but God seems to leave it up to us.
Yes, I think that's, we're supposed to give all our efforts and careful care and do our very best, and then we're also just supposed to be faithful, and God is supposed to act, and yet we have this incredible responsibility as well. So, no, I continue to experience that and on this issue of immigrants and refugees as well.
And, of course, we're going to feel good. We're truly going to be blessed when we open up our hearts to others. We are, by a free will decision, really opening them up to God at the same time, aren't we?
We are. I think that's a promise that Jesus has for us, too, that we are opening ourselves to God when we do this kind of welcoming. So what an invitation it is that we have to welcome others and know that we get to welcome God in our lives in a way, too.
And another quote that you had made is that love without truth is like a boat without a rudder. And I think that through the stories that you told in this book, that's exactly what you were doing. You were telling the truth and the necessary to reach out in love. And previously you talked about personal truthing and other kinds of truthing. And as we close, give us just a short update on your work in Haiti, because we spend a lot of time talking about Haiti previously.
Yes, I was just down, and I'll start just by saying it's so great to be with you, Father Ron, and you're the best at this. You're so good at leading thoughtful conversations. I wanted to get that in. But I was just in Haiti a month ago. I continue, though less percentage of my time, I'm very much for life committed to Haiti, and I love the earlier conversations with you about Haiti, and also invite you and your listeners to be praying for Haiti. The projects we've been working on have been encouraging and better than they've ever been, but the country's been really in some turmoil for the last several months, and then the last couple of weeks even more so. So I've been talking with friends and colleagues down there, as it's political turmoil, but related to just how the grind of poverty for so many people there is so hard to endure, you know, and to make it through. So there's so much beauty there. I'm inspired by Haiti all the time. I love being there last month, and we just launched a new education program down there that I think will be great for the country in the long term, but also it's a country that continues for different political and economic reasons to be in some turmoil. So I think we want to keep Haiti in our thoughts and prayers and in our giving and support as well.
Our guest this evening has been Kent Annan, talking about his book, You Welcomed Me, Loving Refugees and Immigrants Because God First Loved Us. Kent, thank you for being with us once again. And I hope if you have another book in the future, you'll let us know. Love to have you back.
Indeed.
All right.
Thanks for the chance to be with you.
Thank you. Good night. Bless you and your family.
Thank you. You as well,
All
Father
right.
Ron.
Bye now. So much that one learns from a program like this, that there are things that seem so complex to us and so difficult to reach out and help other people, and yet it really isn't that difficult, especially when you realize you never do it alone. At least it begins with God, and then you find out that when you get engaged in helping someone, especially through an organization, as Kent was talking about, that we can do things locally or nationally. We find out that we're working with other people. And when we give hope, as I mentioned earlier, we receive hope. And we live in a world where we need to know that. We need to experience that, that hope is very much alive, and that comes to us from God. To repeat again the fact that God loves each of us now as he will ever love us, because it's the only way that we can live our lives, that God doesn't want us to be drawn into the wrong thinking of others, certainly not to be drawn into their hatred, but to form around us a circle of love, that area of influence that each of us has. I'm so eager to say it may be one person, it may be two people, it may be your family, it may be larger than your family, it may be where you work, might be your neighborhood, you know, and it goes on and on. But each of us has been given an area where we are to try to influence people and to show them how much God loves them. We're so blinded to that life around us takes our attention, and we don't really give that much time to God. And yet love is the only true power that can help us to resolve the problems that exist in our life today. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, how much would you pray if you truly believe that in the power of prayer you have something of God's goodness, you have something of God's power? It's alive within you and working through you, and you can help little by little, to overcome so many of the problems that exist in your life, in your area of influence. Kent writes in his book, Here in Life, here is life in overcoming real concerns and fear with truth and life. Here is life after the aftermath of loss, violence, suffering, and walking away from home for days. Here is life in then working tenaciously for hope and home. Here is life because God so welcomes us that we welcome each other. Here is life because when we welcome strangers, we welcome the life giver. Here is life because God's kingdom keeps coming on earth in heaven. Here is life when you are very welcome. Here is life when you are welcoming. Here is a life of love worth living, and worth living together. Don't forget then how precious life is and how powerful love is. Tell someone now that you love him or her. Pray for peace as if it depended on you alone. And come back next Sunday and amplify with us.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
You're jamming your favorite song, and while you aren't missing a beat, you could be missing a signal from your body. It's an SOS from your kidneys, and it doesn't sound like music at all. It's silent. High blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and other risk factors can quietly stress the kidneys, leading to negative impacts on the heart. That's why you should ask your doctor about a simple urine test called UACR. Most miss the signal for hidden kidney disease and related heart risk. You shouldn't. Visit detecttheSOS.com today to learn more.
I need a job with a steady paycheck.
I need a job that offers health care on day one for me and my kids.
I want a job where I can get certified in technical roles, like robotics or software engineering.
In communities across the country, hourly Amazon employees earn an average of over $23 an hour, with opportunities to grow their skills and their paycheck by enrolling in free skills training programs and apprenticeships. Learn more at aboutamazon.com.